Now, from the left coast, another in-depth interview from Peter B. Collins. Peter B.'s been talking about news and politics since Watergate and generously shares his knowledge, wisdom, opinions, and outrage here because his friends and family can't take it anymore. Peter B.'s an independent progressive who upsets Democrats and Republicans as conditions require and is one of the few lefty pundits who predicted Trump would win. This podcast is funded entirely by listeners like you, and subscribers get first access to these in-depth interviews. When you're ready, go to peterbcollins.com/signup. Now, here's your humble host, Peter B. Collins.
Thanks for downloading the latest in-depth interview podcast from peterbcollins.com. Journalist Aaron Maté, who writes for The Nation, returns to talk with us today, just hours after Robert Mueller popped Roger Stone, arresting him at dawn at gunpoint with 29 agents. There's a lot of theater involved in this Russiagate scandal, but not a lot of substance related to the original allegations of collusion and Russian meddling in our election. I think you'll find this a fascinating conversation. We talk about Roger Stone, about the BuzzFeed misdirect article of Michael Cohen ordered to lie by Trump, and many other recent issues related to the Russiagate narrative. This program's made possible by listeners like you who support my work with your subscriptions, like Benny Alto in Oregon, Carla Mahoney, Andrew Harnack, and a new subscriber, Polina Vasilyev. I appreciate each and every one of you. And if you never hear your name here, you can fix that. Just sign up for a new subscription today at peterbcollins.com. It's a rare moment for me trotting out sticks for intro music to a podcast. But today we've been treated to a new chapter in Robert Mueller's grand delusion. Get your tickets for the show. Early this morning, and I'm speaking to you on Friday, January 25th, 29 agents of the FBI or other law enforcement agencies arrived at the home of Roger Stone at 6 o'clock in the morning, and brandishing guns, scaring his wife and his dog. They arrested him, and he has posted bail. And there is an indictment that's been issued by Robert Mueller's team. And we're going to discuss that, among other things, with Aaron Maté. He is the reporter who writes quite credibly at The Nation. And he, like me, has been skeptical of the Russiagate narrative since its inception. Aaron, thanks for being with us again today.
Thanks for having me back.
Well, there are interesting developments, at least in terms of the way the corporate media plays progress in the Mueller investigation. And I've had a chance to read all 24 pages of Mueller's indictment of Roger Stone, and all I find are allegations that he lied to Congress and lied to other investigators. And this is more of the same, in my opinion. What's your initial take on this?
Yeah, I mean, for all of the innuendo and, supposed bombshell developments, the underlying fact is that to date, there's yet to be any allegations or even claims from Mueller pertaining to a Trump-Russia conspiracy or even of any crimes committed during the 2016 campaign. And that remains the case today with Roger Stone. It was obvious to me, you know, from looking closely at Roger Stone's public statements and getting past the speculation about it, that he had no inside track to WikiLeaks, that he basically is doing what he's always done all his life, which is be a BS artist, to be a fraud.
You can say bullshit here.
Okay. Well, so it was obvious to me that Roger Stone, in doing what he's done, which is claiming that he had some inside track to WikiLeaks, that he was bullshitting, yeah, which is something he's done for his entire career. And somehow, I think because, you know, Russiagate is based on a conspiracy theory, I mean, any possible statement will be seized upon as as being a source of hope for corroborating it. And so Roger Stone has become this central figure where it's speculated that he might have been the channel between WikiLeaks and the Trump campaign. And this indictment today underscores the fact that he wasn't. I mean, there's even we know already that the only communication we'd heard about previously publicly between Roger Stone and WikiLeaks was WikiLeaks sending Roger Stone a message saying, please stop claiming that we are that we have a connection, because we don't. And that's reinforced today again in the indictment. And it's basically the indictment comes down to Roger Stone being indicted for lying to congressional committees about his communications with two people, Randy Credico and Jerome Corsi, who he thought could be his conduit to WikiLeaks, but they weren't even. They also had no inside information themselves. So it's basically a con man being indicted for lying to Congress about his contacts with two people who also had no real contacts with WikiLeaks.
Now, Corsi outed himself months ago and said he expected to be indicted, but that hasn't happened so far. It appears he was just a conduit, you know, in certain circumstances between Stone and getting information out of WikiLeaks. And the same is true of Randy Credico. He appears on Pacifica Radio. He interviewed Assange, and it's clear it was his first interview in August of 2016. And yet Stone, you know, the self-styled dirty trickster of politics, he tried to aggrandize himself by making it seem like he had this direct pipeline to Julian Assange.
Yeah. What Stone did, I mean, it's true. He was in contact with Randy Credico. But Randy Credico wasn't even in contact with Assange. Randy Credico knows somebody on Assange's legal team. But he didn't even have any inside scoop. I mean, everything that Stone said publicly about what he knew could either be inferred from public statements that Assange had already made, or he was guessing. You know, like, for example, it's, you know, like Stone has this famous tweet where he says that it's the Podesta's time in the barrel. Well, so that was taken to mean that Roger Stone knew in advance that Julian Assange had John Podesta's emails. But really, I think the day of or the day before Stone tweeted that, Breitbart had a piece about John Podesta being involved with in the same sort of shady financial dealings that Manafort was, you know. And so I think that, for example, is what Roger Stone was taking his wild guess from.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so it's and this indictment underscores that. I mean, there's no indictment here that Roger Stone conspired with WikiLeaks, relayed a secret back, relayed any communication from WikiLeaks to the Trump campaign. The only role of the Trump campaign here is that a Trump campaign official, who we now know as Steve Bannon, asked Roger Stone what WikiLeaks had coming up. But Bannon did that after the first releases of emails from WikiLeaks. So like everybody, the Trump campaign wanted to know what was going on. And mm-hmm. the fact is they thought, because of Roger Stone's public statements, that he might be able to help them. But we know from the fact that Mueller doesn't allege anything that he couldn't, you know. And also, if the Trump team and Russia were supposedly conspiring, then why is it that Steve Bannon, after the first WikiLeaks emails are released, is asking Roger Stone about it? Is asking Roger Stone what he knows.
Because Papadopoulos wasn't there anymore.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. Right.
The indictment is seven counts, and Stone testified falsely. Stone testified falsely. Stone testified falsely. Stone testified falsely. Number six, Stone testified falsely. And number seven is the same. So it's all about a process here, and this is really significant because the corporate media and the fans of Russiagate blow right past all that. Let me read the lead sentence from the New York Times report on the Stone indictments. The special counsel, Robert S. Mueller III, revealed on Friday the most direct link yet between the Trump campaign's and WikiLeaks' parallel efforts to use Democratic Party material stolen by Russians to damage the election campaign of Hillary Clinton. Now, once again, the assertion that the material was stolen by Russians remains unproven publicly, and yet the New York Times treats that as fact. And then it describes this as the most direct link, and of course, the thing that leaked from a Manafort document about instructing Konstantin Kilimnik to share polling information that the New York Times got wrong. That's just another example of the way they are, mixing speculation with fact and presenting speculation as fact on a repeated basis.
To underscore your point, let me read to you from what the New York Times wrote when it reported about that story about Manafort sharing polling data.
Mm-hmm.
This is the second sentence of that piece. The document provided the clearest evidence to date that the Trump campaign may have tried to coordinate with Russians during the 2016 presidential race. So this claim about Manafort sharing polling data a few weeks ago, that was the clearest evidence to date. Now with Roger Stone being arrested, that is the most direct link. So it's like it's every single story. It's portrayed in a way to fit a narrative, not based on its actual merits, because again, as we know now, basically what that claim about Manafort showed is that in the spring of 2016, as Trump was wrapping up the nomination, he hadn't even won it yet. Manafort asked his Russian fixer, Konstantin Kilimnik, mm-hmm. his Russian Ukrainian fixer, I should say, Konstantin Kilimnik, to share polling data that was most of it was public. With two Ukrainian tycoons who he had worked for before. Now, initially, the Times reported it falsely as Manafort instructing Kilimnik to share it with Oleg Deripaska, who is a Russian tycoon. So mm-hmm. even the initial New York Times story turned out to be false. And now again, now they're trying to make something out of this Roger Stone indictment, that where the only Trump campaign role here is Steve Bannon, after the WikiLeaks emails are publicly released, asking Roger Stone what else WikiLeaks has coming up. And Roger Stone can't even tell him anything concrete because, of course, Roger Stone doesn't know.
Implicit in these claims, most direct link yet, and the strongest evidence of collusion to date, is that all the stuff that they've fed us before is total bullshit.
Exactly right.
These are such lame claims, the most direct link. It is mind-boggling to see an outlet like the New York Times operate at this juvenile level.
Everything, exactly as you say, everything is done with sort of qualified, suggestive language to make it appear as if something. But when you look at it, the substance is actually, it's pretty much worthless. I mean, it's like the fact that something is the clearest thing to date doesn't mean anything if we haven't gotten anything actually incriminating so far, and that remains the case. The fact is that in these, the New York Times and the Washington Post occasionally admit the truth. They've written long pieces where quietly they fit in acknowledgments that there is no evidence to date. Like, let me read to you a couple. They say, one New York Times piece recently said that Trump is right that no public evidence has emerged showing his campaign conspired with Russia in the election interference or accepted Russian money. Now, that was buried in a 10,000-word piece mm-hmm. called The Plot to Subvert an Election.
That was September of 18.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Washington Post had a piece recently about how the Trump camp – how 14 Trump associates have interacted with Russians. Not Russian officials, but just people with Russian passports.
Yeah.
And in that piece, they also acknowledge Mueller has not yet shown that any of the dozens of interactions between people in Trump's orbit and Russians resulted in any specific coordination between his presidential campaign and Russia. And finally, there was recently this piece in the New York Times that revealed that the FBI opened up a counterintelligence probe of Trump in the spring of 2017 as being a possible agent of Russia. And they also acknowledge no evidence has emerged publicly that Trump was secretly in contact with or took direction from Russian government officials. So the truth is sometimes acknowledged.
Yeah.
But it's buried in this barrage of constant innuendo and suggestive qualified language that misleads people to thinking otherwise. And, look at the consequence. I mean, the fact is, it's 2019 and we're still talking about this as if it's serious.
Here's the caveat paragraph in today's Roger Stone indictment article. The indictment does not mention whether Mr. Stone or any other Trump associate knew about the Russian operatives' plans before they hacked the Democrats. And again, they're asserting that Russia hacked them without proof, right? They continue to make a case that Trump's associates conspired with the Russians. The investigators indicated they needed to show that the associates knew about the hacks in advance. Knowing about the fruits of what Russia stole was not enough.
Now, exactly right.
You know, this is comical in so many respects, but the way it is played in the media, many people just take it at face value. And I want to take a moment here to share a story about St. Bob Mueller, because this guy is treated as, you know, Elliot Ness, whatever character you want to play, that he's uncorruptible. He's just the straightest of straight shooters. And I have office neighbors here in San Rafael, California. And when Bob Mueller was the U.S. attorney in San Francisco, before Dianne Feinstein was the mentor who got him the job as FBI director, he staged a raid on the offices next door. It's a small company. They make devices that are testing units for nuclear power plants and nuclear medicine, and they operate worldwide. And at the time, there were sanctions on Iran, and one of the boxes from this company next door somehow wound up in Iran. And instead of calling or even just dropping off, you know, some investigative questions, they did a raid early in the morning, guns drawn, terrifying the people who worked there who had no idea this was coming. And I'll keep the story brief because, you know, it's just another example of the overkill that we saw Mueller use in arresting Manafort and now in arresting Roger Stone. And this is part of his playbook. And the investigation of this company next door ultimately was settled when they hired a powerful Republican former U.S. attorney as their counsel. And he had lunch with Bob Mueller and it went away. So, you know, the idea that this guy is just so invincible and, you know, leak proof and all this stuff, CNN says they didn't get a tip off that the arrest was coming, but they had crews at Roger Stone's home at 6 o'clock this morning to capture the takedown. I mean, all we need is that guy from To Catch a Predator.
Exactly right.
To show up.
Well, that speaks to just, you know, how what a performance this whole thing is, and how, you know, in the absence of any substance of a single allegation having to do with Mueller's core mandate, I mean, this thing has just become a carnival, you know, something for the cameras. It's exciting for cable news ratings, but it's bad for everybody else because we're all talking about the details instead of, for example, talking about the fact that today is the end of the shutdown, you know. So, you know, and I think that's part of the intent of those who have been pushing Russiagate, people who have an interest in not wanting to talk about real issues, but want to, you know, if you're a Democratic Party elite, you want to distract from your own failures in 2016 and blame Russia. And if you're a member of the corporate media, you don't want to actually challenge Trump in a meaningful way and challenge, you know, the people who really make decisions about our politics, powerful corporations and the like. You want to instead make it about Russia and sort of and in the process boost your ratings. So it's the whole thing is just it's funny, but it's also tragic.
And Aaron, the past week has been fascinating and bizarre in a number of ways. I want to reference before we move on too far from what you talked about your article at The Nation, where you showed how the New York Times corrected its article, claiming that Manafort had instructed Kilimnik to share the mostly public polling information with colleagues in Ukraine, not in Russia, as the New York Times originally reported. But just two nights ago, Rachel Maddow used the headline, the uncorrected headline, from that New York Times original story and used it as a building block to further, you know, develop conspiracy ideas around Manafort, when the convictions are all related to things of his own personal corruption and effort to evade taxes and registering as a foreign agent. And so, you know, she is unfazed in using information that has been corrected in a false manner to sustain the narrative of what I call her telenovela.
Exactly right. And what is all the more disingenuous about this, the coverage of Manafort and just Russiagate in general, is that you, all these cases actually undermine the conspiracy theory. So, for example, in the case of Manafort, it's said that, you know, they somehow try to make his case relevant to Russiagate by saying that when he was in Ukraine committing the crimes that he was ultimately convicted of, that he was doing the bidding of the Kremlin. He was working for pro-Kremlin interests. In fact, it's the exact opposite. Manafort was working for the Ukrainian president, Yanukovych, who is a member of the Party of Regions, which is traditionally has been affiliated with Russia. But Manafort, in terms of what he was doing, Manafort was pushing Yanukovych to away from Russia and to align with the European Union, and that issue of whether or not Yanukovych was going to sign a trade agreement with the EU or with Russia was the basis for the Maidan crisis and helped set off this new Cold War we're in between the US and Russia. And Manafort, as Mueller's own documents make clear, because in Mueller's indictments of Manafort in this case, has released a whole bunch of internal documents where you have Manafort emailing his colleagues, emailing even Yanukovych himself, outlining his strategy, which he crafted, called Engage Ukraine. And Engage Ukraine, in Manafort's own words, was a strategy to reinforce the messaging that Ukraine should not fall to Russia and should integrate with the West. So not only does Manafort's case itself, the charges, have nothing to do with the issue of a conspiracy, because they're all about tax fraud and lobbying and other financial fraud. Mm-hmm. They actually undermine the conspiracy because they show that Manafort was working against Russian interests during his time in Ukraine.
And Greg Craig and Tony Podesta are waiting for shoes to drop. They clearly violated the Foreign Agents Registration Act, but they were working, being paid by Manafort through a phony nonprofit set up in Europe to lobby on behalf of Ukraine in the United States. And part of that was to bring Ukraine into the NATO-EU orbit and try to separate it from Russia. And that strategy clearly was not in the interests of Putin and does not, at least nominally, make Manafort a tool of Putin.
Exactly right. It makes him the opposite. And in fact, from what I know from people who really know the story, is that Manafort was a source of annoyance inside Moscow, because he was seen, rightfully, as being someone who was trying to pull Yanukovych away from Russia, mm-hmm. you know? And in fact, you know, recently even there was one former White House lawyer in the Obama administration who was recently made a plea deal with the DOJ because of lying to them related to his work for Manafort in this case. Which underscores how bipartisan this was.
And who was that, Aaron? I don't know that case.
It's Greg Craig.
Oh, it is Craig.
Yeah.
I didn't know he took a plea deal. There was a settlement with his law firm, and they disgorged the money that they had been paid to essentially represent Ukraine. But I didn't hear that Craig got a separate personal plea there.
Well, okay, to be clear. So this was his former firm,
right?
Skadden, Arps, Slate, Meager, and Flom, which mm-hmm. just recently made the plea with the DOJ. And what they admitted to was that Craig's statements were false.
Okay, yeah. But he personally hasn't faced any deal with Mueller that I'm aware of.
Right, correct. He has not. Mm-hmm. It was his firm that made that deal mm-hmm. on his behalf, pretty much, I'd say.
Now, we are now 1 week since BuzzFeed dominated the news cycle with a report that they stand by, and as of today, I have this quote from the BuzzFeed website headline: President Trump directed his attorney Michael Cohen to lie to Congress about the Moscow Tower project. Second story, more and more Democrats are suggesting Trump should be impeached after he told his lawyer, Michael Cohen, to lie to Congress. Now, I need to share with you that the co-author of that story is Jason Leopold, a longtime colleague of mine. I've known him for more than 15 years. And I will acknowledge that I believed his what turned out to be a false report that Karl Rove had been indicted, and I got burned on that particular one. And when the BuzzFeed story surfaced, I was very cautious about it, Aaron, and I said, you know, I respect the work that Jason Leopold does with FOIA because he's got evidence in his hands. He is basing his reporting on hard evidence. And he's been nominated for a Pulitzer. That series that he and other BuzzFeed reporters worked on was loaded with anonymous sources and circumstantial evidence behind a fundamental claim of Putin assassinating figures mostly in the United Kingdom. And so I have told Jason directly that I am very uncomfortable with the reporting he does based on leaks and anonymous sources. And in my most recent interview with him, he got very defensive when we aired out our differences about that. So with that said, this story did draw a very unusual correction, or at least a kind of unusual denial from the special counsel's office. Now, many people like me have read it as not a full-throated denial, but I heard in one of the interviews that you did recently that you kind of think that that's just unnecessary parsing. Is that right?
Of course. I mean, I don't understand how it can't be seen as an unequivocal denial. First of all, I mean, the Washington Post has done reporting saying that the – according to their sources, for what it's worth, I mean, you know – we have to be equal here, so I can't just accept these sources on faith. But for what it's worth, the Washington Post, in speaking to DOJ officials, says that it was meant as a denial of the core assertions. And the fact is that Mueller's statement said that claims about evidence and testimony gathered by Mueller's office are not accurate.
Right.
And given that the story is basically like the premise of it is that Mueller has gathered evidence and collected testimony from Cohen that Trump told him to lie, I don't see how Mueller coming out with a statement like that can't be seen as an unequivocal denial, especially because Mueller has not spoken out on any story to date.
Right. Well, here's what I wrestle with, because we know that Trump had an outsized misunderstanding of attorney-client privilege. And his tweet when Cohen's offices were searched, really expressed that. And we have Michael Cohen's at least one recording of what I would call a coded conversation with Trump, where he's talking about David Pecker, the National Enquirer boss, and the efforts to, buy and kill the story of the Playboy playmate who asserted she had an affair with Trump. And so I consider it plausible. I do understand that we're dealing in an area here where we don't have evidence, and I am skeptical of the BuzzFeed report, but ultimately it seems consistent with Trump's behavior.
Okay. I'll tell you why I don't think it's plausible, or at least it's possible, I think, because anything's possible, but I don't think it's plausible. Here's why. And, I pointed this out even before Mueller's statement. First of all, the motive to me seems so strange. We're talking about a Trump Moscow deal that went nowhere. Trump signed a letter of intent with a second tier Moscow bank, but there was never any Russian government approval. There was never any Russian government financing. The only Kremlin interaction with the Trump organization about it comes after Michael Cohen emails a general email address at the Kremlin asking for help. And he gets a phone call back from an assistant to the press secretary, where, according to all accounts, he was told, well, we don't build houses, but if you want to come to this St. Petersburg forum in June, you're welcome to come.
Right.
The rest of it is basically Cohen and his colleague, Felix Sater, in the Trump organization fighting with each other, and Cohen expressing increasing frustration that Sater was going to make him look bad because he keeps promising, you know, financing from this Russian bank, VTB. He keeps promising meetings with high-level Russian officials, but he doesn't deliver. So beyond a letter of intent and the fact that an architect was commissioned to draw up some plans, there's not much here. And so why Trump would then now, after all this has been publicly revealed, tell Cohen to lie about it to Congress doesn't even make sense, especially since Cohen – it's not as if Cohen's statements to Congress were basically that he told Congress that he spoke to Trump about it three times when in fact he later on admitted that he spoke to him about it more than three times. And he also told Congress that conversations about it ended in January 2016. But really, him and Felix Sater talked about it up until June. Mm-hmm. So even if Cohen had told Congress the truth about what happened, it's not as if Trump would have been any better off. I mean, like either way, it doesn't really impact Trump. So the motive to me wasn't there. And also the claim of BuzzFeed just made no sense. BuzzFeed says that Mueller was able to figure out that Trump told Cohen to lie through emails, text messages, witness testimony, and other documents. Mm-hmm. Well, does it make sense that an impeachable offense like that of telling Cohen to lie is going to be contained in emails, text messages, and other documents? I mean, like, you'd think if Trump had made such a explosive directive that they would have covered it up better. So
I agree with you. I on this, I believe that BuzzFeed has overstated this, and this bold statement, President Trump directed his attorney to lie to Congress. People don't do it that way. Even Nixon, you know, he would suggest things. You can say, I don't remember. You can say, I can't recall.
Exactly right.
And so, you know, the idea that Trump just said, well, Michael, here's what you say. I don't think Trump is that stupid. And so it gives me pause. I do acknowledge that. But I still am wrestling with this a bit because despite Jason Leopold's history, BuzzFeed has, I believe, tried to lawyer this stuff and, you know, they're continuing to stand by it is a bit surprising, frankly.
But it's easy to stand by these stories. I don't think they made up the fact. Look, the fact is they've even acknowledged, or at least one of the reporters on the story has acknowledged that they haven't seen the evidence. The supposed
Cormier.
Underlying evidence, exactly, yeah. Cormier, the supposed underlying evidence that they say Mueller has. So what's strange is that Cormier told CNN that they have not seen the evidence. Leopold said that they have seen evidence, although it's possible he was speaking generally about documents in general. Mm-hmm. But on the surface, at least, they made conflicting statements. And if we believe Cormier, at least, they have not seen the underlying evidence. So basically, I do think they were. I don't think they're lying. I do think that two people told them this, right? Mm-hmm. But this would not be the first time that two people have told reporters something, especially about Russiagate, and got it totally wrong. So, for example, you know, not long ago, both CNN and MSNBC reported that Donald Trump Jr. was given the WikiLeaks emails before they were publicly released.
Right.
It turned out pretty quickly that actually he was given the emails after they were publicly released.
Well, you know, and the litany of misstatements, inaccuracies, and flat-out falsehoods that have been published in the mainstream media well exceeds the offenses of BuzzFeed. And I do want to credit Glenn Greenwald for creating a listicle. That's a BuzzFeed style, where he listed his top 10 most egregious offenses of journalism in this whole episode. And to me, he missed the biggest one, which I pointed out in my quotes from the New York Times about the Stone indictment, which is these broad claims of things treated as fact, which are still, unproven publicly and should be properly offset by alleged, suspected, it's been reported, it's been asserted, but they have dispensed with that language. And to me, that's one of the gravest big crimes against journalism that has been occurring.
It's very clear that there are people inside the government leaking either false claims or leaking in a very selective way. So, for example, in the false category, In February 2017, New York Times reported that that the FBI had intercepted communications between Manafort and Russian intelligence officials. And this was not batted down until 4 months later when James Comey testified that he said in the main that was not true. You know, but a story like that gets reported and stays out there, and you know, it becomes sort of it gets repeated enough that it sort of sinks in and people start believing that it's true. And you know, one rejection from Comey is not enough to remove the impression that it leaves. You know, and it's in terms of selective leaks, then we had the fact that, you know, when Michael Flynn's contacts with the Russian ambassador were leaked, mm-hmm. right, which was, you know, the after the election, Flynn spoke to the Russian ambassador a few times. Yep. And we didn't learn until later on what the content of those calls was. But basically that created an impression of Flynn and the Russian ambassador having some secret coordination. And it was never just acknowledged that the fact that these calls could even be leaked means that the calls were monitored. But yet Michael Flynn's never been charged for anything for doing anything improper in these calls. He's only been charged with misleading the FBI about it. But although even there's some, you know, there's some dispute over what actually happened. And Flynn's attorneys have suggested that he was entrapped, although that's a whole other long story.
Well, and Mueller gave him a pass on what I think was the most serious offense, which was lobbying for Turkey while he was on the Trump campaign.
Exactly
that,
right. And
that,
by the
that
way,
scene is just, never mind.
Yeah, exactly right. And by the way, my theory there is that I you know, based on everything I've read in this case, I mean, I wasn't there, so I don't know. I don't think that Flynn would have pled to lying had he not also faced the far more serious charges about the Turkish lobbying, which was right. Much more serious, carried way bigger fines and way more time in prison. So I think Mueller got him to plead to the more sort of on the surface explosive charge of lying to the FBI.
Aaron, I know your time is tight today. I want to just reference for our listeners that you refer to Max Blumenthal's work exposing the Integrity Initiative, this information warfare campaign that's run by a nominal charity in Britain, but the guy who runs it is a military intelligence officer. And I think that is another fascinating component of this whole massive story. But as we wrap up, I want to get your thoughts because the Democrats are not doing anything to stop the confirmation of Bill Barr as Attorney General. And in his confirmation hearings, he made it very clear that when St. Bob Mueller submits his report on this whole investigation, that he, Bill Barr, is going to read it, and then he's going to write his own report, which will be released to the public. And so I would like you to offer us a little speculation about where all this goes when Mueller wraps up, irrespective of whether he proves collusion or not. What is the outcome? And are many of the people who think that this is going to have a clean ending going to be disappointed?
I can't speculate to that degree because I don't know. I mean, certainly if things go as they've gone for the last nearly 2 years, Mueller will give us a report that has zero to do with his mandate, which is I don't think he'll if this trend continues, he will have no allegations of a Trump-Russia conspiracy or even of any crimes committed during the 2016 campaign. Now, how people respond to that, if that's what happens, I don't know. Certainly, I think Russiagate has taught us that even very smart, educated people are willing to fit the developments to meet their own narrative. And I do think that Mueller does carry more weight. So, for example, I can say that there's no evidence of a Trump-Russia conspiracy, but if Mueller were to come out and say that clearly, that might carry more weight with people because he's been exalted to such a level. Mm-hmm. You know, if he – depending on how cynical Mueller is and depending how much he cares about – he's thinking about his personal legacy, and he doesn't want to be remembered as the guy who let Trump off the hook and who was soft on Russia. Then maybe he'll throw in some suggestive language, you know, that talks about unresolved questions or, you know, leaves it open to imagination and interpretation. Basically, gives people some material to work with to continue their conspiracy theory. But, you know, I'm hoping if he's minimally serious, that he won't go that route and he'll write an honest report. And that, you know, I'm hoping that if Robert Mueller's word is not enough, then nothing else will. And you know, like, this thing will go on for as long as people feel compelled to make something out of it. But, you know, for those of us who are serious, who take the facts seriously, I mean, I personally am not a Trump fan. I'd love to see him voted out of office. But, you know, as I've said before, you know, Trump, I think, conned his way into office by portraying himself as a working class champion. And I don't think he's going to be undone by a con. I think he'll be undone by his own con and challenging him on his own policies, which are hurting the working class. Not going to be undone by a con, which is this notion that he was installed by Russia and worked with them to do it.
Aaron Maté, always a pleasure to talk with you. I enjoy your work at The Nation. You recently departed from the Real News Network. Are you ready to announce any new affiliation?
Not yet, but I'm working on it. I love doing daily news and interviewing people, especially challenging people and having sort of some sort of debates. And I love doing that on this issue, especially on Russiagate, because it was very it's been sorely lacking in the media. And so I hope to be doing it again very soon.
All right. Well, keep us posted and we'll talk again soon. Aaron Maté here on the Peter B. Collins podcast. Thanks, Aaron.
Thank you, Peter.
I'd appreciate your comments about this in-depth interview with Aaron Maté. Email Peter at peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.